I got a question for you, though. Would you ask that question to a man?
This dealer went from broke to dealer principal of a top five Toyota store in the nation. And like all trailblazers, the path to her success wasn't easy. Today on the Car Dealership Guy podcast, I'm speaking with Julie Herrera, president of Idea Auto Group, serving Toyota and Subaru customers in the heart of Texas. Before we get into the show, this episode is brought to you by the Auto Hauler Exchange. Auto Hauler Exchange is changing how people who send and carry cars work together. Now, if you need to send a car, you can directly work with carriers all over the country. And if you carry cars, you don't have to look through brokers' lists to find good, fair jobs anymore. By eliminating the middleman, all shipments on the Auto Hauler Exchange come directly from the owner of the vehicle being shipped, with carriers receiving real shipment opportunities at direct pricing. Auto Hauler Exchange helps shippers and carriers work together easily and clearly, adding transparency and making better partnerships. Get off the auto hauling roller coaster by getting on the Auto Hauler Exchange. To learn more, visit autohaulerexchange.com or click the link in the show notes below. This episode is also brought to you by CDK Global. CDK Global has been empowering nearly 15,000 dealers with the tools and technology they need to build deeper relationships with customers. Their team is keenly aware of the state of dealership technology, and while many vendors promise seamless experiences between your CRM, DMS, digital retail, and fixed ops, most of these bolt-on solutions tend to break workflows and cause more harm than good. That is why CDK has launched a new dealership experience platform. This new integrated software consists of everything you need to operate a dealership efficiently while delivering an unparalleled experience to your customers. Basically, everything working together, not separate, one system to run your dealership as opposed to 10. CDK developed it with an outside-in approach, listening to dealers every step of the way. You can learn more about CDK's dealership experience platform by visiting cdkglobal.com/DXP or clicking the link in the show notes below. For those that are watching this, I know, you know, most people actually listen, believe it or not, but for those watching, you have a pretty interesting sword behind your head. Tell us about that. What is this?
I do. That's a Japanese katana sword that was given to me from Toyota when I got the Toyota franchise in 2017. So they presented that sword to me on our grand opening day, and I keep it behind my desk for fun, just in case I get any bad actors in my office. I can whip it out. And actually, I've only taken it out of its case one time, but it's a really iconic one. Yeah. So.
All right. I like you already. What a great way to start. Well, I'm excited for our conversation. You've done some tremendous things, broken through some real barriers in the industry, which we'll dig into today. You're the number five highest volume Toyota store in the country. Is that correct?
I think we're sitting at number five this year. We finished at number two last year. It'll be an interesting good dogfight to see where we end up. I think the East Coast and the West Coast kind of have their, you know, they're back in the game. They figured out with more cars, they're able to sell a little more. So we're going to have to raise our game if we want to keep number two in the nation spot. So looking forward to that. But yeah.
Did you think 30 years ago, right? Did you think you'd be in the car business and make it this far?
Absolutely not. I've been in the industry now a little over 30 years. That 30 years, I stopped saying the exact years. I just say 30 plus now because it's really good. But no, looking back at those early days, selling aftermarket at a Chevy store in San Antonio, just needed to make a little money. I was so sick of being broke. I never would have fathomed that I could stay in it this long and persevere and make it to this level of today. So yeah, crazy, pretty crazy.
So tell us about your beginnings in the industry, right? How did you even get started in cars?
Sure. So I'm really going to date myself then. So I answered an ad in the newspaper for aftermarket sales lady. I had no idea what that was. I needed a job. I had gone a couple of years college. I was so sick of being broke. And I said, I'm just going to work this summer. I'm not going to school. And so I walk into a Chevy store in San Antonio, Texas, and they hire me on the spot. And they said, okay, you're going to sell this package to every customer before they go into finance. And it was literally a box, okay? And then the box is all this mop and glow aftermarket items. And so I'm selling this aftermarket product. And after about 2 weeks, I thought, gosh, I'd rather sell that Corvette and that Suburban and that truck. So so I got all the courage up and went into the general manager and said, I'd like to sell cars instead of this products. And he said, really? Well, ladies really don't do that. It's a difficult job. It's, you know, it's negotiating. It's going in. You're out in the sun. It's weekends. It's late nights. And I said, okay, well, when can I start? And I'm just standing in his office. It was extremely awkward. He did not want me to sell cars. And he said, well, if you really want to do this, you understand it's 100% commission. And I said, I get it. I said, I want to try this. And they gave me a shot. The new car manager, I'll never forget, his name was Donnie Prather, good old guy. And he put me out there and taught me a little bit about how to sell cars. And I stayed with it. I just put my head down and decided to learn the industry and to ask a ton of questions and to never give up. So I was just so sick of being broke that I ended up at a car dealership. It was an accident. Nobody recruited me in. They weren't looking for women at that time.
You were looking for an opportunity. Let me ask you this, though. What was it about your personality that motivated you to go against the grain? Right? Like it's easier to say, hey, well, you know what? He's right. It's the 90s, right? I'm a woman. Maybe I shouldn't be selling cars. What was it about your personality? Why were you being rebellious, quote unquote, at the time relative to the stigma? What was happening through your head?
Well, if you asked my mother that, she'd say that was exactly who I was. I was always asking, why not? Why can't I? And, you know, I have five brothers. I played college basketball. I was pretty resilient. But what appealed to me the most about the opportunity was simple. I got to be in charge of my destiny. I got to decide how much money I make. I got to decide how many I sell, how many appointments I set. What will my front gross profit be? What will my back gross profit be? What will my commission be? And I would play little games with myself. I would write out a fake check and have it under my desk mat and say, I'm going to make this much this month. And nobody could tell me that I couldn't do it. I was in charge of, you know, my destiny for the first time as a 23-year-old. And to me, that really appealed to me. My daddy was in the car business and he did really well. My uncle was in the car business. I did not tell my parents when I did this. They figured it out a couple of months later when I didn't call for money for a while. But, you know, I wasn't necessarily raised around the business. My father was a sales manager for several dealerships, and he had a small used car lot of his own. He didn't quite have the opportunities that I was going to have in my day in automotive. But so I guess it was a little in my blood, but I love the fact that you could do as much as you wanted to with it. And that really appealed to me. So
I want to ask you a broader question. What has it been like? You've seen decades of just, you know, automotive evolving here. And I'm saying that as a, you know, I commend you. That's obviously impressive and you've seen a lot. And so my question to you is, what has it been like to be, you know, a woman and an up and comer in automotive 30 years ago or in the 90s, right? Versus today. What were some of the biggest differences? I can't empathize, right? I'm a man, I'm a guy, like I have no idea. The way I always saw it at our dealership, I mean, if we found a female or someone that wanted to enter the business and, you know, even start in sales, I mean, we were enthused because we always felt like they did better, right? It's just human nature. Like women performed really well on the floor. And I'm generalizing, but for the most part, it seemed to be the case. But anyway, so what were like the biggest differences back then, right? Especially as an up-and-comer and someone that was a high performer.
Yeah, well, obviously, first of all, the industry has become much more regulated and it's come a long way. I'll tell you, it was difficult. The journey was difficult. You know, there just wasn't any role models at all in automotive. Women, there was very few. You had to beg to get trained. You had to push for everything. The environment wasn't a really healthy environment for ladies. We've come a long way in the industry. We still struggle with attracting more talent into our industry, but there's been a lot of change for the good over the years. I know when I got in and after a few years, I thought, gosh, this is a really cool business. I could do some things here. And I remember just putting my head down and wanting to work and to keep learning. And I had to push for every promotion. I had to raise my hand every time. I had to prove myself over and over. And it was just harder for the GMs at the time or the dealers at the time to see a lady in the role of director of a department or a general sales manager, much less a general manager. So you were constantly having to do your homework. You were constantly having to outperform the others, and you had to get along with everybody. Because if not, if you're too firm, then, you know, there's other words that they call a lady in the industry. So you're always dancing and playing this game of, I need to perform because it's a scoreboard industry. I need to keep learning. I need to keep raising my hand. But boy, I better get along with everybody or I'm really not going to get a shot. So you have to be a heck of a teammate. And even then, it will be difficult. And even then, it will be, you know, for anybody, I think it's difficult for the guys too. So I love the changes in the industry. I think we've gotten a lot better. One of the corny goals I always had was, why don't we just make it better? Why don't we just make the industry better where you're proud to be a part of it? And for 30 plus years, that's the simple thing I've been trying to do. I actually want salespeople to be proud that they're salespeople and to be proud of the title sale. It's not a negative thing. So I think we've grown as an industry. I think it's gotten better. I think it's gotten quicker. When you raise your hand now and you want something, you can go to NADA Academy. You can get in and get additional training. I mean, I literally had to fight for those opportunities back in the 90s and 2000s until I could get heard. So
tell us about, at what point were you promoted to general manager?
So it took a long time. I think I was thinking about that. I think it was 2008. But prior to that, I was a general sales manager of a very large Toyota volume store. We were the number one retail volume store in the San Antonio market. That's a big market here in Texas. I think there's 6 Toyota stores in that market. And I got that opportunity. So a lot of people would say that's pretty much equivalent to being a GM because it's such a large department. And that variable department, I think I was in charge of 150 people. And we were selling 650 new and used cars and President's Cabinet Award, hitting all the leasing penetrations, all the things they asked us to do. The general manager first job was Cavender Audi in San Antonio. And it was only for 14 months. And right after I got that position, Toyota didn't want me to leave Toyota. And they said, why don't you apply for an open point? So I said, absolutely. And that story took off from there. So I was only a general manager for a very short time, and I jumped right into dealer principal, which is a blessing. And I think that a lot of people don't get that opportunity, and I was able to get that opportunity. So
what was that like? I mean, first of all, you've been doing this, you mentioned 14 months GM, a new store. Right. I mean, really, you're only a little bit over a year in. So you're starting to really make your impact. This opportunity comes in. What goes through your mind?
Yeah, I think before they asked me to apply for this new open point, Gulf States Toyota, the distributor in all of the Gulf States here, there's 165 dealers in Gulf States Toyota. They had a couple of things moving around and they were going to put a new point in Brownsville, Texas, which is at the tip of Texas. You're basically in Mexico. And, you know, I didn't really want to move there, but I went ahead and jumped in the game. I thought, you got to get in the batter's box and say you want something and see how it goes. So we applied for that, my investor partners and I, and I felt clearly like we were the best candidate. We were not picked. And so I said, okay, well, it wasn't meant to be. Let's get back to work. At the time, I had taken the leap from variable. And I was running the fixed operations department of Cavender Toyota, which is a very large, high volume, top 10 Toyota dealer in the country. I took that position to get Toyota's attention and to learn the back end of the store. It was in their store. There's crazy stories about that, I can tell you. But so I went back to work. I put my head down and I'm in fixed operations. I've got grease under my nails. I'm running a big group there. I'm learning fixed operations. And we get another call from Gulf States Toyota. And they said, Julie, we want to talk to you. And they said, the reason we didn't pick you for the open point in Brownsville, Texas, is we have something else for you. I said, fabulous. What is it? So it was Toyota Cedar Park and a brand new point here in North Austin. So they said, after you applied, we saw what you brought to the table and we wanted you in this market, which was a huge blessing. Obviously, this is a very, very big market, growing leaps and bounds in every direction all around the Austin Metro. So fortunately, was the last person standing and was awarded the new point. And we opened our doors for business in 2017, May of 2017. So it's been a wild ride since then. Yeah.
You've had a crazy run. Tell us a little bit about what it was like to actually open this point, right? For people listening that, you know, maybe have these type of aspirations, how do you actually do it? How did you capitalize it, right? Like, give us the behind the scenes.
Yeah. So first of all, it's absolutely nerve-wracking. I had very, very good investor partners that they're car dealers and they're in the San Antonio market and they wanted to help me and I wanted to help them. I wanted to get my foot in the door. So they came to the table with a lot of money. I came to the table with every dollar I had. We pushed it and went all in and I moved up to the Austin market. I didn't bring one employee. I knew that the Austin market was very different than the San Antonio market. I also had been running fixed operations for the previous 4 years, so I didn't have a lot of variable people on my side. I move into Austin with my spouse and my two dogs and my mother, and we get to work. The building's going up. Gulf States Toyota was very instrumental in picking the land, and we picked out, you know, all the stuff on the building. You're getting it all going. About 4 months out, you start to hire your talent. The first person I hired was my parts and service director. He was from the market. I knew him by running into him, but I knew after spending 4 years in parts and service that it's going to be difficult to find technicians, to find a great shop foreman, and to find service advisors. I knew I could find variable people. I knew there was salespeople that wanted to work here and finance people, sales managers. So I hired Cecil first. We've had a great run together and he's still here on the team. Then we hired a controller, I hired HR person, and then we got a shop foreman. So we just started building it. Once I had HR in, we're getting a little closer, but literally had to hire 135 people within a few months, train, establish culture, put people in positions, and launch this giant I call it 767. It's a big store. We built it with the goal in mind that this market can support it. We were heavy on expense. We were heavy on personnel. But I didn't want to think small because I knew the brand, Toyota, and I knew Austin. I knew that we were meant for something really big. Thank God we were right.
Yeah, it's crazy. This episode is brought to you by my very own Car Dealership Guy Industry Job Board. CDGjobs.com, my industry job board connecting the best talent in automotive with the best companies, will remain absolutely free for CDG listeners to post and fill available roles at their companies. This free job board is for anyone in automotive, vendors, dealers, lenders, manufacturers, auto tech, everyone. Already, over 100 companies have posted open positions, including Lithia Motors, Recurrent, Credit Acceptance, Viros Credit, Cars Commerce, Shift Digital, Plug, Fullpath, Westlake, Trade Pending. You get the point. The best part is that when these companies hire through cdgjobs.com, they are hiring the most informed candidates in the marketplace. So don't hesitate. You can add your open roles today by visiting cdgjobs.com or clicking the link in the show notes below. That's cdgjobs.com. A couple questions that I want to dig in there. So first of all, everyone is always talking about staffing, fixed ops, service. How did you find your fixed ops team? Right? You mentioned it was difficult, but how did you do it?
Well, I knew the importance, like I said. So I knew that hiring a fixed operations director first was going to be key because they have all the contacts.
They have the team, yes.
Technicians are careful, you know. Technicians don't just jump around. They have to feel comfortable. They have to know somebody. Immediately, we hired the shop foreman that came in. They had both excellent reputations. Tech started calling. We went through and visited three local high schools. Their CTE programs, automotive technician programs, immediately set up relationships so that we could have a pipeline of technicians coming in. I'm very hands-on. I mean, I rolled up my sleeves. We're involved in everything. We start getting all the contacts and we start building this team. And, you know, throughout the first 12 months of operation, you're pulling your hair out. You're not making much money. You're figuring out that some people aren't going to be your culture. You're figuring out that some aren't talented in this area. You're moving people around. There's a ton of moving parts. But we never wavered on our process of taking amazing care of our customers. And we literally wrote all of our sales processes with the customer in mind. And the customers in this market loved it. They said, oh, finally, someone's listening to us. So things like express purchase were basically 90% of their transactions online. And they just come in to test drive and pick up. And
what year was this, Julie?
This was 2017. We had online shopping before the pandemic because I knew the market was, this market is, you know, very high technology market. I mean, it's home to a lot of high tech companies. So came in, we said, they're not going to want, we're going to make this special. We need to listen. So literally paperless transaction, paperless F&I transaction, tablet-based write-up on the sales side, as well as the service side. Multi-point inspection video. I mean, we literally send you a video of your car as we're inspecting it. And the market ate it up. They said, this is pretty forward thinking. Finally, a dealership operating the way we want. And so it worked. It really worked.
Yeah.
And
it clearly worked in hindsight. You've made it pretty far, I would say, in a short time. Tell us, so you were ahead of the curve in 2017. What's on your mind today in terms of processes, systems that you feel are maybe ahead of the curve? What are you doing today that's a bit different than the broader market?
Yeah, every year we're heading into ADA. We're looking at different, going to different digital seminars. We want to know what's the next thing, because the minute you're not thinking that way, you're already getting behind. Okay. You know, most people say, gosh, you're number two in the nation last year. Why are you thinking about all this? But AI obviously is going to take a big role in our industry. And I mean, heck, I'm old enough to remember when the internet came and they said, we're going to sell cars on the internet. We laughed about it. And then I thought, gosh, you know, this may really happen. But with AI, I think there's so much out there. We're looking at some neat products right now. I don't want to tell everybody about them, but you know, we have these huge owner banks in our stores and we got to figure out how to properly communicate with our customers better, how to target what they're really looking for. What if your customer has three Toyotas, but now somebody in their family is online looking at a Subaru? How do we know that? I have a Subaru franchise also, and I'm working on a third franchise right now. So in my mind, to be able to take amazing care of your customers, you have to be able to communicate with them effectively so that you're not always out there trying to get more customers. You're harvesting and taking great care of the ones you have. And marketing specifically to what they're looking for or that their wants and needs are in their household. Everybody knows that people have three and four cars. So I want to look into that more. I found some companies that use AI to be able to dig into what their existing owner bank is looking at when they look at other products, because I want to sell them those other products. So there's some interesting things. That's just one thing, but I think that...
And any specific names you can share with our audience?
Well, I'll tell you, at NADA, we went to a very good showing with me and my team with Full Path. And they have an exceptional product. And we immediately saw that and said, let's look at it.
I will just say that Full Path is a partner of this podcast, and this was
absolutely
not pre-planned. So totally organic. And that's pretty cool to hear. But anyways, you keep going. Cause the second you said that, I'm sure people are like, wait a second, Full Path is an advertiser. Yeah. So anyways, I wanted to make sure that I put that out there, but yeah, go ahead.
Actually, they were brought to me by our chief marketing officer. And she said, I think we need to look into this. And you know, she's always looking at ways to target and market specifically to what the customer's looking for. And the way it was explained to me, and a lot of it's over my head, but the way it was explained to me is we can really know what our customers, if they're servicing with us, and they go home and 3 days later, they're on their tablet and they're looking up, you know, a Nissan, and you own a Nissan store. Well, great. You know, let's talk to them. Let's send them some. I think there's going to be some cool things coming up with respect to AI, and that should help us. So
I want to dig in more on your transition, right, from GM to dealer principal. Just, there's a lot of people that listen to this in podcasts who are GMs. There's also lots of dealer principals. my first question on that is, for aspiring dealer principals who are currently GMs, right? What was the biggest kind of mindset shift for you as you went from one role to the next, right? What would you say was the biggest change for you?
Well, first of all, to go to the next level, you have to absolutely, unequivocally believe that you can. You have to speak it into existence. I want to be a dealer. I want to be a dealer principal. I want to figure this out. And for me, I didn't know any other dealers that were female, that weren't millionaires. And I mean, there was nobody like me. So you have to change your own thinking. That would be the first thing I'd say to get you there. But and it's kind of a hard shift because you're operational and you're used to being the general manager and you're used to being involved in every little thing. I had to learn to step back a little bit and ask myself, what is my role now? And as we grow and add additional points, I'm more of an executive now. I'm not involved in every little decision. So that took a little bit of, you know, it hit me a little bit because I was used to being a little bit of a control freak and a little bit involved in everything. But I'd say that my role now as the dealer is the protector of the people. I'm the protector of the process and the culture. And decisions that I make now are, well, if we use this company for our benefits, you know, how is it going to affect our employees? What type of expenses involved? If we use, you know, this company for our 401k, are the administrative fees this much? How can I match some of that? What can I do that's different that most dealers aren't doing? So I find myself now looking at things that are people development, decision-making on how to take care of that our employees really well, and then how to keep our culture. And I say culture a lot, and to me, it's a winning culture, but it's also a kindness-first culture. And I know that might sound goofy, but in this business, I have found that you can really win in a lot of ways if you're kind and if you're taking care of each other and taking care of your customer. The soft skills of what have been missing from this industry for so long, and I think they're damn important. You know, my retention is incredible. People don't want to leave. Now, am I firm? Heck yeah. Do I hold them accountable? Heck yeah. You don't get to be, you know, top dealer in the nation and all of that unless you're, you know, you have a firm set of rules that you follow by. But they know you care. And they know you care by how you treat, what their schedule looks like, what kind of money they make, what kind of opportunity and career path they may be on. Did you take them to NADA this year? Did you take them to a different seminar? Did you send them to NADA Academy? Did they get training? When you're doing all that, there's no dispute whether you care about them or not. I have 6 graduates from NADA Academy, and I'm sending 2 more this year. The guys at the Academy called me and says, what are you doing? I said, educating people on the car business, the stuff that I never got to do because my dealers wouldn't let me go is wrong. And so the soft skills are important, and you'll find out you'll be amazingly profitable and you'll have extremely high retention if you just pay attention a little bit to the people side of things. So I find myself doing a lot of that as the dealer now.
All right. So Julie, in car dealership guy style fashion, as we like to, you know, we like to say the quiet part out loud, right? So if someone's listening to this now and they're like, oh, well, you know what? Julie is a woman in the industry. You know, she's a minority. That's why she had the opportunity for an open point or to grow like she did. How do you respond to that?
Well, you know, that's always going to be said. But I will tell you this. I worked every dang job just like everybody else did. I sold cars for 7 years, new and used. I went to finance. While in finance, I went to freaking night school, you know, 2 days a week to finish my degree. I then get out of there. I said yes to every job. They put me through the grind to be able to do this. Ran huge used car dealerships. Then after variable, 23 years of variable, I knew that I would not get a shot unless I learned fixed. Because when you're a woman, you better know it all, okay? You're not automatically going to be thought of. You have to keep pushing yourself in front of the camera to be able to get a shot. I spent 4.5 years with grease under my nails, running parts and service, 150 people to finally get the attention of a manufacturer say, hey, well, maybe we ought to let her, you know, try to be this dealer. I'd go up against some multi-billionaires. And it wasn't easy. I never wanted it because I was a female, and I never wanted it because I was Hispanic. I wanted it because I was the best person for the job. So the minute I got the job, what did I have to do? Well, you got to go be good because they're going to say, hey, Julie got it because she's a female minority. They gave it to her. Well, bullshit. Okay. You don't become number two in the nation, and you don't sell 1,200 cars a month, and you don't have 520 employees at one store that you hold in because you're a minority or because you're a woman. You do it because you worked your tail off. You deserved it. You put yourself in the light. So bring it on. I'd love that discussion with anybody. So
I love it. You're so good. So on that same note, right, you've put in decades in this industry to really work your way up and prove yourself as you have, which is, again, very commendable. Do you feel like, again, for, I would say specifically even for female listeners here that are listening to the podcast right now and really look up to you. I mean, you've just achieved so much. Does doing what you do, does that come at the expense of family?
Well, absolutely. I think it's an expense whether you're male or female. I think we put in a lot of late nights and a lot of weekends. We miss birthdays. We miss baby showers. It's a tough deal to be in retail. Kind of comes with the game. I will tell you, a lot nicer to myself nowadays, and there's a lot more Saturdays than I have off. But, you know, working any business, I don't care what you do for a living. If you're making any real money and you're making any real difference, you're putting in 70, 80 hours a week sometimes. And that goes for anybody that's lawyer, doctor, whatever industry that you're in, nurse, you're going to put the time in. And that's why you've got to be really good at time management and try to work it out in your household. But I got a question for you, though. Would you ask that question to a man?
I would not. And that's exactly why I asked that question. Because you know what I think is beautiful about this podcast? I think that this podcast is, I try, when I ask a question and when I have the conversation, I try to put myself in the shoes of a listener and the audience. And I try to ask myself, what's going through their mind? Yeah, what's going through their mind, right? Like, what are they thinking? What am I not asking that someone might be thinking? And then I think, if I was a woman right now listening, and I hear this extremely successful woman, and let's just, you know, like the facts are, right, biologically, right, being a woman, you do different things than male, right? You give birth, I mean, 9 months, there's like these like spurts in your career. And so then what I would be thinking if I was a woman right now, I'd be saying, okay, well, like, is that even possible for me? What do I have to give up in order to do what Julie has done? And I think that the conversation around that, I feel like it's super important to have that open conversation, because if it's not you and me right now, then where is it? Who is it? At what forum? How is it going to be? How is it going to be spoken about?
Yeah, and I think times have really changed. I mean, you see a lot more stay-at-home dads. You see a lot more career women. Obviously, you're going to juggle things, especially as a dealer or GM. You're juggling a lot. So I think that you finding the healthy balance for you and your family is the right thing to do. But when there's a determined woman to do something, she's going to find a way. And I think that, you know, it's just, it's one of those things. If you really want to get something done, and you can do it, and you can find a way to have balance with your family also. So,
well, I love just your openness around that, and I appreciate that, you know, that you're able to speak freely of that. So I want to transition, and by the way, talk about, right, keeping it real on the CDG podcast. That's what it's all about. I want to ask you a little bit about just what you're seeing in the market, right? Your actual insight into the current trends today and what's happening, right? We're coming off these crazy couple of years where dealers were doing 3x earnings on an annual basis. Things are, 2023 was sort of a beginning to revert to the mean. 2024 stabilized a little bit so far. What are you currently, and I would say in like a broad picture, right? Before we talk about outlook, what are you currently seeing right now in the market, right? And I'm talking about in all departments, fixed, variable, used, new. What's kind of your overall take right now?
I think things are obviously, any dealer will tell you, things are getting a little bit back to normal. You know, day supplies are up. We're probably have right at a 45, 50 day supply of vehicles. Gross profits are trending back to a more normal area. customers still want you to take great care of them. They still want efficiency. They still want to get in and out. They still want you to be there for them after the sale. In the franchises I have, we are not seeing hardly anybody walking in wanting an EV. It just hasn't been there for us. The Tesla brand does great in this market, but I will tell you, I have five or six of them sitting on my used car lot right now where customers are still saying, hey, we like a dealer. We like to be able to come in and get something taken care of. And we like that you have parts in stock to be able to take care of us. So those are some of the basics we're seeing. Our customers on the service drive want transparency. I love our multi-point inspection video that we work with them. They still want to get in and out as much as they like your facility, as nice as you are and as great it is. So I think people still, they're back to work. They're busy. They want your respect. They want you to respect their intelligence and not waste their time. So, I think we're just getting back to where we were. I don't have a big problem at this location in the Austin market with losing my customers to other dealers. We didn't raise the price over MSRP at the store. We just didn't. And I think they really respected that. We are seeing some customers that are heavily in a negative equity position on their trade-ins in this market. That was something we didn't really see before. So you're seeing some of that, but I think it's going to be a great year. By all indications, the first 2 months, they're January, February, they're not your rock star months, but we're averaging right under 1,200 units a month on both of those months. And we forecasted for this store over 16,000 pieces for next year. We finished with a little over 14,000 last year. So we feel good about the year, but that's kind of the state of the market here, at least in Texas and Central Texas.
What's your outlook for the remainder of the year for 24 between used, new, service? What are you most bullish on?
I think what I'm most bullish on is we're going to start making money again in the used car departments. Our used car grosses were way off last year. And I think that market is stabilizing. Prices are coming down at the auctions. We can buy things a little bit more in line with book value. So I'm excited about that. And then, we've been in growth mode for literally 7.5 years in Austin. It hasn't slowed down. So I'm kind of blessed because the stores that we have are right here in a very busy growing market. But I'm excited about the whole year. I think it's going to be great. I know it's an election year. I hate listening to all that crap. I like to stay focused on the things that we can control. And you can let your head go way negative if you want to. What I try to do is stay focused on what's going on in our little area and just own this primary marketing area. And, I'm surprised we're able to keep the gross profit we've been able to keep on new cars.
Well, that was my next question, because I was going to ask you about margin compression. Are you concerned about new car margin compression with supply increasing pretty rapidly? And look, I know you're a Toyota store, so you're like the hot shit right now, right? You're the lowest day supply. Everyone still wants your product, but not everyone's in that position, right? Does margin compression concern you at all?
It does a little bit. I will tell you, you started to see it come down. And at the last quarter of last year, I said, let's change our thinking. Let's look inward. Why do we have to lose the profitability? Why aren't we doing a great needs assessment? Why aren't we doing a great product presentation, a great demo ride? Why aren't we building value? Let's get back to those basics to keep the profitability so that we can keep what we've done. I think it all starts with what's going on between these two ears. And if you set your mind to a higher level of thinking and don't just go, oh, well, the market's doing, oh, well, we're going to have to take some losers. We're overstocked on Tundra right now. We can do that. But why do we just have to give up and shortcut all the things that make our profitability happen? So I think a lot of it is leadership and a lot of it is mindset. And we'll see how it goes. So far it's working. We're holding on pretty good. So I'm not as worried about that, but we all got excited over those last years. Everybody was making crazy money, and And now it's back to reality and basics of sales. So
tell us about the name for your group. You know, I was checking out your website. I saw, I mean, it just looks very different, right? Like you don't expect it from a dealer group, an auto group. Like your logo is like, it's very thin typeface, like the lettering. It almost looks like a premium brand. Of course, the name idea, which I want you to talk about as well. Can you tell us a little bit about the evolution of this? Like how you ideated this, right? No pun intended. Why you came up with this? Like give us a little bit of background to that.
Yeah. So, and our logo does look a little feminine, I think. I mean, it is a lady run group, but the idea behind idea was I wanted to make a little bit of a difference, and this team here wanted to make a little bit of a difference in automotive. And idea is about inclusion. It's about helping diversify automotive. It's about, you know, trying to recruit and retain and train more women in automotive and more minorities. It's kind of one of those topics where, you know, I don't want anything because we're minority. I just want to help make the dealer body look more like the consumers. And we have a very diverse consumer base. There's a lot of Asian Americans in the Austin market. There's a lot of Indian Americans in the Austin market and Hispanics in Texas. And I just think that it's harder to get a break when you don't have a daddy that gave it to you or a granddaddy that gave it to you or a family with multi-millions of dollars. So the idea is let's recruit and train and keep and develop more women and more minority talent. And let's make a case for this blue collar group of people that we get into the business. It means so much to us. Nobody gave it to us. So that's the passion behind it. In no means do I want to exclude anybody from that. I have amazing white male guys that are GMs with me that are amazing. But I wanted to focus a little bit more attention on that. And I wanted to, you know, not just make a living, make a little bit of a difference in automotive. So that was the idea.
And it's very, again, like very respectable how you've done that and again, achieved financial success. I think that's the fact that you worked your way up and you're such a Toyota powerhouse. I really do think it's impressive to do multiple things. It's hard enough to do the latter, right? Just to sell cars and manage that business on its own is hard enough as it is. So the fact that you're combining sort of like a personal mission in addition to that, kudos to you on doing that.
Thank you. I really appreciate that.
Yeah. And, you know, just piggybacking off that, what's your personal mission as you, I know you're very involved in the industry, right? You mentioned, and when I say very involved, I mean, in other ways, other than just selling cars. And this is really what everything is rooted in, what you just mentioned. But what is really your goal for the industry? Like, what would you like to see changed or evolved over this next decade?
I mean, pretty much what I was just talking about. I mean, right now, 84% is the latest I heard. 84% of the buyers on a new car in the United States of America, all right, are either by a woman or the woman made the decision for that family. And we've all heard these for years. Every year we hear all the statistics. But dang, it's still less than 5% women own automobile dealerships. It's absolutely crazy. So we got to figure it out. And I think that women can really help the perception of the industry. Women tend to do things a little bit differently. If you walk into to any of the stores that I run, it's clean, it's fresh, there's fresh flowers, there's smiling faces, there's cookies in the smell, there's a cafe, there's wonderful. I just want it to be a better experience. And I know a lot of dealers do that. We're trying to go to another level. I want unreasonable hospitality. I want people to go, holy mother, they just bought a car here and they're leaving. There's a bow on every car, as if it was Lexus December to remember every day at Toyota Cedar Park and every day at City Limits Subaru. It's just a passion to make it better. And I think it comes from, you know, feeling like, gosh, you know, I got into sales because I was broke. And people look at sales as a negative thing. Why do we look at sales as a negative thing? Why can't it be friendly experts? you know, friendly experts, passionate about the industry, helping people buy what they want to buy, you know. And I get people say, oh gosh, Julie, you know, it's really, you know, you're not going to be great doing it that way. Well, they're absolutely wrong. You can be amazingly great doing it the right way and using your soft skills and making a difference in the industry. I just wanted to be proud of the industry I was in, and I wasn't real proud in those first few years until I found the right dealers to work with and I learned how I wanted to do things. And that's when we talk culture, that's what the culture is. So listen, if we don't change as dealers, okay, you're going to continue to have Carvanas and Teslas and people buying online. If we don't get better, it's our fault. We are not good enough to take care of our customers. We're not doing it right. So I think that we got to put our money where our mouth is and start taking better care of each other and our customers.
So what's next for you? You briefly mentioned you're looking at another store. What's on the horizon?
Well, I tell you that I've been asked a lot that question by CFO and our Moss Adams partners, and they want to know how many and how much. I want to continue to grow. I don't want manufacturers. I don't want other stores for no reason. I want to do it calculated for opportunities with these GM candidates that we've been developing to put them in as operators. If it's the right market, if it's the right manufacturer, you know, I don't want 20, 30, 50, 80 stores. I want probably, you know, 5 to 7, but I want to be in the top 5 in volume in every damn one of them. So they can't say, well, you know, they changed their model. They're not doing what Julie was saying. I think that, you know, we can make a difference in a community with changing automotive to a better space. And we can retail a lot of units doing it the right way too. So that's kind of the goal for now. We'll see how it rolls. And I mean, obviously I'd love to be a luxury dealer. I'd love to have a few franchises are on my list that haven't called me back yet, but we'll keep working on it.
I just had another guest on a podcast and they said a line that I liked, which is, if we can't be the largest, can we be the best? And so I like that mindset. There's many ways to the top. So you're definitely embarking on one.
There you go. There you go. I like it.
Julie Herrera, this was awesome. Thanks so much for coming on. I really had a pleasure.
Hey, thank you. I appreciate it.
All right. Hope you enjoyed that episode. Please give the podcast a rating, consider subscribing to the show, and check the show notes for links to what we talked about. Thanks for tuning in. I'll see you guys next time.